Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton, ARK Invest's chief futurist and the host of FYI. With me today, we have Charlie Roberts, our chief investment strategist and a multi-time founder in the multi-omic space. And Dr. Nemo Despot and Dr. Charlie Roberts. Nemo's our analyst in the multi-omic space. We have a great show for you today. Nemo and Charlie interviewed the now Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Professor David Baker, and it was one of multiple Nobel Prizes that were issued in kind of the AI space. Nemo, why don't you tell us, what did he win the Nobel Prize for, please?
Professor David Baker is absolute leader in the space of the protein design and protein engineering. So he's best known for developing the computational tools to design the proteins and predict their three-dimensional structure. One of them is known as the Rosetta Fold. So he has been a true pioneer in the field in the last 20, 30 years, published more than 600 publications. But the Nobel Prize came basically in his work in developing the computational methods, such as Rosetta Fold, in predicting the tree, the structure from the sequence of the proteins.
So then Rosetta Fold played a key role in allowing AlphaFold to actually, like, in generating the data that helped AlphaFold to predict protein structure, right?
Yes and no. Well, they're both doing the same thing. So Rosetta Fold is the way that David Baker developed to go from the sequence to predict the structure. And then the AlphaFold is another kind of different way of doing that. Rosetta is much older way. And, you know, before we were just be able to actually predict the, you know, smaller parts of the proteins. And that's what Rosetta was doing. But then over the time and how the AlphaFold was progressing, Rosetta was also able to actually kind of predict the complete structure of the protein.
Great. And Charlie, so you have a lot of experience trying to practically deploy artificial intelligence against kind of like business outcomes in the multi-omic space. You know, how do you think kind of the breakthrough that David Baker has in part led in being able to design proteins is going to translate into kind of medicine and health outcomes?
I mean, a huge amount of what we talk a bit about this in the podcast itself. A huge amount of what matters in healthcare is if we're going to effectively, you know, do what I would argue is one of the most important things we're trying to do, is really affect new cures and better therapies that help patients ultimately. That should be, and I think is, one of the big end games for many of the people in the space. The huge problem there is that so much of the health data that's out there is just observational and correlative. There's very little in the way of causation that's embedded into the health data sets we have. And a lot of the, and well, guess what? You know, generating data which gets at causality is expensive and time consuming, and there's just not a lot of it. So the ability to simulate and to simulate at scale with a very high fidelity to reality is a huge, huge leg up. And it allows this whole, I mean, if you look at what DeepMind did, obviously Demis, who's one of the other, the founder of DeepMind, Demis Hassabis, who is one of the other recipients of this Nobel Prize. You know, a huge amount of the work DeepMind did was in reinforcement learning and games. And so that's the whole, you know, a lot of this philosophy has come from. In biology, we've not had the ability to really do that and have these recursive feedback loops of generating knowledge from having some rules in a system and then be able to let a computer simulate and play through that system. And I think what this directionally does, this sort of research, is it puts the constraints and some awareness enough about the biology, then you can generate a ton of new data that's not just wild fantasy. And if that then helps get us to causality, because we suddenly understand and we can tie structure to function, which is the core building blocks of understanding in biology, then that is much more likely to lead to better therapies, which is really what I am obviously care about, and I think a ton of people in the space do.
Yeah, that's one of the things that stood out to me in the interview is kind of he talked about how the protein structures that we knew experimentally were so important to being able to deploy deep learning to get simulated protein structure from amino acid information, right? And that then we're lacking in actually robust data sets on, you know, what is the protein to something else interaction look like? And so then that, you know, of course, bridged me into, oh, well, it's kind of by getting better at predicting protein structure, you'll be better at predicting those interactions. And then you're going to tie that into wet lab in the loop type operations to actually get the data that then trains the next model. And you're going to kind of like build up this pyramid of kind of simulated and empirical understanding together piecewise from there.
Yeah, no, I think here as well, you know, for me, you know, this Nobel Prize. So number one, you know, AlphaFold was 2020, the AlphaFold, the original one. And so in 2024, we already have a Nobel Prize. And so just kind of show, you know, Nobel Prize usually takes some time because they want to see that something is very used and it actually has the meaning that it is supposed to, importance actually, not the meaning. And here in 4 years, you know, the Nobel Prize is given. So I think, you know, it's a huge validation. But bigger thing here is really understanding how fundamental is the kind of developing the foundational models in biology. You know, just because of the vast complexity, you know, of all the possible structure, information systems, whatever you're modeling, experimentally kind of you're recording all of that, measuring, it's not going to happen. We need to be able to develop foundational models and then actually like that kind of, you know, circumvent the huge need for a lot of experimentation that would be never basically possible. And so here, you know, this, I think this is a great example where we see that. And then, you know, obviously on top of that, opens so many other kind of doors in the drug discovery, especially kind of space.
Yeah, I mean, from a business perspective, the reason this is impactful and these breakthroughs are impactful is because potentially it allows companies to develop better molecules that they can, you know, apply to different therapies for less R&D costs in and more efficacy on the back end. And so from an investor perspective, if you can identify those companies, then you get a better return on your investor capital. And kind of these are the tools that these companies are going to use to get there.
This is a great tool. This is the step in the right direction. You know, this is also not like answer for everything, right? You know, we can predict the structure, which is great, but we predict static structure. These are dynamic, you know, proteins are very dynamic. And so this is the right step. The next step is like, how do we actually incorporate thermodynamics, molecular dynamics, and those things in these models? You know, because that's going to be the next layer. And, you know, maybe that's the future with the quantum computing and those things. And this is definitely, again, opening so many new doors, but, you know, this is not like solution for everything. You know, it's just the right step. It's a step in the right direction.
I think a final point just also is this is a really good example of a friendly and polite arms race in science done in the right way. So between the Baker Lab and DeepMind, there's been this ongoing kind of polite, friendly rivalry almost, where I think the early work with Rosetta that David Baker did back going back several decades informed and gave some of the background to the problems that DeepMind would work on. And then actually DeepMind made a massive leap forward that then spurred off more progress from the Baker Lab. And actually, David gave an interesting endpoints podcast a few weeks ago on the Endpoints channel and an AI pharma conversation, and said actually he had tried a lot of the things that DeepMind ended up making work, but gave up on them until he saw DeepMind redo that and then realized that where maybe they'd made mistakes or should have just carried on and then did that and then did that more. And then DeepMind, you know, it was like a game of kind of scientific tennis, and it's got to an amazing place, and it's fantastic to see multiple folks at multiple research groups recognized, which is exactly what the Nobel Prize should do.
Yeah, and it's very clear that we are very early in this game of tennis, and that some of the things he talks about doing in the podcast, like developing synthetic molecular machinery, it seems like we're so far, like I can't even imagine how you would, you know, successfully, you know, construct something that has like kind of literally biological molecular mechanics going on. And you know, there's a lot of utility you can get out of even these first incremental steps. So look forward to you listening to the interview, and thank you for joining FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to our FYI, or For Your Innovation podcast. I'm Nemo, and I'm the Multiomic Analyst, and today I'm joined with Professor David Baker, one of the frontiers and the leaders in the protein sequence structure prediction and protein engineering. So welcome, Professor Baker. So maybe if we could just first start telling us a little bit about your path. So, you know, maybe even like from the earlier days of your kind of PhD, how did you came, you know, where did you started and how did you end up here now where you are, you know, one of the leading scientists in the protein engineering and design?
Well, it certainly wasn't a direct path. I started off actually not even sure I was interested in science. I kind of became a biology major in my last year in college. And then I got excited about sort of advances in molecular biology. And I went to graduate school thinking I wanted to work on developmental biology, or really how the brain works. And I ended up working on doing a PhD on sort of trying to figure out how cells get organized. And then I got interested in sort of even the simpler case of biological self-organization, which is sort of like proteins and how they fold. So when I came to the University of Washington, we started off trying to understand how proteins fold up, how the amino acid sequence of a protein specifies its three-dimensional structure. We did a lot of experiments to try and figure out how that worked, and then we incorporated the insights from those experiments into a structure prediction method, which we called Rosetta. And then after we had made some progress in going from amino acid sequence to structure, we realized that we could turn it around and instead go from we could make up brand new structures and work backwards to find amino acid sequences that encode those. And that led us into protein design. And then from there, we realized that now we have this opportunity to make, you know, to make a whole new host of proteins to solve modern day proteins. And that's the problems. And that's really what we've been focusing on since.
Great. And maybe, you know, just for our audience, because we have a really broad audience, scientific and non-scientific, maybe you could just set up the problem. Why predicting actually the structure of the protein from the sequence of the is so hard and challenging?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll focus on the problem of designing new proteins. That's the thing that's probably closest to my heart right now. So let me give a little bit of introduction to proteins. So what proteins are the miniature machines that carry out essentially all the important functions in our bodies and in all living things. So like the DNA is like the blueprint, but the proteins are what actually does all the work. They digest our food, they empower movement, they basically, you know, they mediate the electric currents going through our brains when we think. And so all these proteins that that exist in nature came through natural selection, came through evolution. So they were pretty much the products of random chance plus selection over a very, very long period of time. And they solved the problems that came about during evolution really extremely well. You know, you think about how well our bodies work, it's really kind of a miracle. But we face new problems today. And so if we had sort of, you know, billions of years to wait, probably new proteins would evolve to help solve them, like, you know, neurodegenerative disease. There's new kinds of pathogens. We're heating up the planet. There are all these kinds of problems that humans have. And up until, you know, fairly recently, you know, the only proteins we knew were the proteins that exist in nature. But now we figured out how to design brand new ones that solve new problems. And so I would say the general protein design problem is, you know, given a 21st century challenge, how do you design proteins to solve it?
Great. And so when we think about designing the proteins, are we able actually to really design the proteins even there, like with their tertiary and quaternary structures, or we are still kind of really good kind of in designing the secondary structures and combining those?
We can now design, you know, really complex structures and position each atom exactly where we want it. So, for example, I'll just give you some recent examples. So Susanna, a student in the lab, has designed proteins which neutralize the major components of snake venom. So snake venom has these toxins that, you know, that can kill you in various ways. And she's designed proteins which just fit totally perfectly around them and prevent them from acting. We can also design proteins which position atoms in just the right place to catalyze chemical reactions. So we can now design really complicated proteins with every group in exactly the right place to carry out the new function or job that we want it to carry out.
Can you tell us a little more then about kind of Rosetta Stone and, you know, how actually that was helping us in this kind of design? And an additional question is, what are some still of the hurdles that we have in the design? What we still need to kind of achieve?
So for many years, we were improving our ability to model proteins. And so just a little bit more background there, as you suggested. So proteins, the proteins in our bodies are encoded by the genes in our genomes. And so for each protein, there's a gene, and the gene specifies as the amino acid sequence of the protein. And there are 20 amino acids. And so at each position of protein, you have one of those 20 amino acids. So it's kind of like a long code word. And then that amino acids, that sequence of amino acids determines what the three-dimensional structure is. And so when we say design a new protein, what we mean is make up a new shape on the computer and then find an amino acid sequence that will fold exactly to that shape. And so the first way we tried to do this was to actually mimic the process of folding. So we sort of were understanding how proteins fold, and we tried to mimic that process on the computer. And that was the Rosetta method. And there we were modeling all of the atoms in the protein and how they interact with each other and searching for like the folded state, which is the state which has where the interactions have the lowest energy. Now, in the last 4 years, this has really been revolutionized. Transformed, we now have replaced this kind of physical modeling with generative AI methods, deep learning methods, which let us actually design proteins much more accurately and with higher success rates than before. And one of the methods that we've developed are called RF diffusion. It's very much like DALL-E or the methods that generate images on the internet. So you can say to a program like DALL-E, you know, generate a picture of a cauliflower on a horse, and it will do that. It starts with completely random image, and then it progressively transforms it into an image of a cauliflower riding on a horse. In the same way, we can, with RF diffusion, we can start with a completely random distribution of amino acids and say, design a protein or assemble this into a protein that will bind to the influenza virus or block this cancer target. And then the amino acids come together in such a way as to have that function.
Maybe we can touch base a little more on these generative AI models. So are the generative AI models, so they are basically learning from the structures that we already have? And do they incorporate some of these thermodynamical equations into them actually to kind of predict the structures?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So Rosetta, the physically based method, is full of equations that describe the physics of the interactions. The AI methods, like RF diffusion, have no equations of that form in there. They are very deep neural networks with hundreds of millions of parameters that are entirely learned on examples of proteins of known structure. So biologists have over the last 40 years determined the three-dimensional structures of hundreds of thousands of proteins, and RF diffusion, like other programs like AlphaFold for structure prediction, are simply trained on this database to relate sequences to structures.
To the extent that structure follows function in biology, and obviously function is everything if we're looking at actually creating new drugs and finding unearthing novel or new discoveries in causal biology, how have you found or how do you see the landscape emerging in terms of actually interrogating these deep neural networks to actually uncover causality or functionality as opposed to just lots of observation of what's occurring? And how does that causal interrogation, if you like, interact with what we're learning about structure?
I think you would need to train the network on a different sort of data. Like, the networks, as I said, are trained on sequences and structures. If you want to get at causality and higher order function, then you would need to train on data where you had, interactions between proteins and interactions between proteins and other things with functions labeled. Currently, all of the inference of function and the design of function is provided say in RF diffusion, if you want to design a new protein with a new function, you condition on structural properties which you hypothesize are related to that function. So the simplest type of function is to bind a target protein, like a viral protein. So in that case, it's pretty easy to condition. You provide the target protein. You start your generative AI with just a random cloud of protein residues, which sort of comes together, and you get order out of the void around the target. So then you basically get the function because the protein that you've designed now is incredibly shape matching to the target. For more general types of functions, you may have to hypothesize about what a structural property that would give rise to that function is. So if you want to design something that breaks down plastic, something I'm working on, you have to describe an active site of a protein which you hypothesize would break down plastic. You make proteins, you design proteins that have that particular catalytic site, and then you can measure experimentally whether they actually break down plastic.
To the extent that determining function is important for finding new targets and novel biology, if that's indeed an area you're interested in, it sounds like it is maybe in some settings, maybe even outside human disease, is the loss function and the objective well circumscribed, I guess, is one question. And do we know what we're training for? Is that an area of active development and active research? And secondly, what would you say, if any, are the obstacles preventing us getting to the promised land of really being able to characterize many things right through, where we can model right through to functionality?
Again, I'm sort of focusing my comments on the protein design problem, where there the challenge is designing proteins with new functions. And as you said before, you know, what the intermediary between sequence and function is structure. So if you can describe structural properties that would give rise to the function of interest, then you can design that function. If you want to create a new function, but you have no idea what structural features would correlate with it, it's hard. And the same is true for prediction, which I think is the problem you were getting at. So let's say you have a genome and you want to ascribe function to every protein. You can now predict accurately the structures of a large fraction of the proteins in that genome, but predicting function is hard because it's not a totally well posed problem. These functions often involve not just one protein, but many proteins and small molecules and other things all interacting together. So if you're just given the sequence of one protein, then you're missing a lot of the information. So perhaps a better posed problem is, given the components of biomolecular assembly, the sequences of the proteins and nucleic acids, and the small molecules that constitute it, predict what the function is. I think that's a far more tractable problem. You don't have that when you just go from genome sequence information. You just have the sequences of the individual proteins. So generally, some sort of experimental methods are needed to identify what sets of molecules are coming together into biomolecular assemblies. And then once you know those, I think inferring function is much more straightforward.
Got it. Thank you.
You have some fragment of a building, and you want to know what the whole building was or what its function was. It's kind of hard to tell, but if you have all the pieces, then you can sort of say what it's doing, or have much better chance of doing it.
Going back to the kind of thermodynamic modeling, you know, my background, I did my PhD at MIT, and, you know, my thought was always that for proteins, because they are pretty kind of dynamic structure, not only, and I'm talking dynamics when they're actually binding the substrate, but even like when they're not binding, they're still like slightly oscillating. So my thought was always that our way to solve actually protein kind of structure will be really kind of with kind of thermodynamic kind of approach and kind of that kind of modeling. But now again, you know, with generative AI, we are seeing that they're doing this pretty well. So how do you explain that? And do you think that kind of final solution is really kind of some combination of these two approaches together?
Yeah. Well, like I said, for many years, we worked on sort of these energetic, sort of physically based approaches. And for both structure prediction and design, now the AI approaches are more powerful. And I think one way to understand that is one of the challenges with the thermodynamic approaches was developing really accurate energy functions so that you could fully accurately compute the energies of a system composed of, you know, might have many thousands of atoms. And so those energy functions were parameterized. You assumed functional forms, and you found parameters, you found best fit parameters for those functions. Now, when we go to the AI methods, we now have 100 million parameters, and we're not assuming any functional forms. And you know, with a deep neural network, you can approximate, you know, any function. What we're doing instead is we're training on, you know, these hundreds of thousands of structures. Each structure may have thousands of atoms, and each atom, you know, has three really, really well-determined coordinates, you know, X, Y, and Z. So the amount of data that we have available to train on, given the hard work of structural biologists over 40 years, is really massive. And so I think basically one way of looking at it is that the fitting we can do with these AI methods on the structure database is just much more, we can fit much, much more complex models than we could with the older physical models, where we might have, you might have a Leonard Jones equation, for example, with two parameters. And we always knew that the functional forms were approximations. We just didn't have a way of coming up with more accurate functional forms and then parameterizing them, which is what the deep learning methods sort of let you do just by having sufficient number of free parameters. The other thing that was always hard was the search problem. You know, how, when, given a really accurate description of the physical chemistry and knowledge that, say, a protein is going to fold to its lowest energy state, how do you actually find that state? And finding, and that's a very, very hard problem too. And the AI methods are also very good at the search problem. So as they build up protein structures that are not only going to, you know, that in the region that's likely to be very low in energy, and then they, you know, and then as the model settles in during the sort of AI computation, it gets to what effectively would be a very low energy state. So I think the AI methods overcome some of the major challenges that used to plague the physically based methods. I do anticipate that in the long run, there will be a reunification, that the physically based models will be important. For us, we still use them. So suppose we're trying to design proteins with unnatural amino acids or unnatural cofactors. There's not enough data to train models for these unnatural amino acids. So we generally use physical models to model the parts of the system that are difficult to model with the AI methods.
Yeah, great. And then when you think about kind of current AI models, you know, how big of the bottleneck is still the amount of the data that we have? You know, if we are even adding more data, we are hitting the diminishing kind of returns. So just kind of to get that perspective, like, you know, thinking in a year, two, three, five, there'll be more data. Will that be kind of excelling the AI models much more? Or do you think that how much data we have to train, it's already enough?
Well, I think it really depends on the problem. And the strength and limitation of AI methods is the training data, right? So if you have sufficient amount of data, you know, this is what we see for protein structures and protein sequence structure relationships. We can now predict protein structures accurately, and we can design brand new proteins. So I would say the protein structure database is sufficiently deep now to enable those things. But if you want to dock small molecules into proteins, predict what the binding affinity of a small molecule is for a protein, or you want to design a protein to bind to a small molecule with a particular affinity, those things are still hard because we don't have huge databases of proteins bound to widely different small molecules. And we don't really have any kind of databases at all that are reasonable with affinity measurements incorporated. So the things that we can't do now are largely things where the databases are just not big enough. And once one goes beyond structure, it gets harder and harder because the databases just aren't, you know, there was a huge effort to curate the protein structures in the protein data bank, and we'll need more data collection and curation for the things beyond structure.
Gotcha. And David, maybe kind of a related question, what do you feel is the biggest thing that's just not understood, misunderstood, or just sort of in the unknown categories of proteins that AI may or may not help us on Earth in the coming years or even decades?
Well, one of the things I'm really excited on the design front is designing molecular machines. So some of the most complex things that go on in the body, for example, making proteins on ribosomes or you know, sort of all the cleaning up of misfolded things in the cells is done by, or even movement is done in our muscles, is done by machines that convert chemical energy into physical work. And if we could design machines like that, the sky's the limit about what we could, you know, contribute to nanotechnology. So how machines work, these biological machines work, thus far has just been, it's been pretty descriptive. You know, take a naturally occurring machine like actin myosin, which powers muscle. There's a lot of description. So a really exciting problem now that we're working hard is, can we design brand new machines completely from scratch that carry out, you know, new types of processes? That's a really fun problem that we're taking, you know, the most powerful AI methods we've developed to try and tackle.
Gotcha. And do you see, I mean, to the extent a lot of aging as well, and therefore a lot of disease, given how much of aging is, or disease is, diseases associated with aging, and given the role we know that lots of proteins and protein misfolding plays in aging, and in fact, in this SASP, the senescence-associated secretory phenotype that comes from eight cells going through senescence, and indeed proteins like progerin that obviously appear in progeria, but also in physiologic aging, do you see a role for some of this work in actually addressing both disease of aging and maybe even fundamentally health span itself and allowing us people to live longer, healthier, happier lives?
Absolutely. I think, in fact, one of the applications for these sorts of machines I was talking about was disassembling the sorts of aggregates and amyloids that that occur in neurodegenerative disease. And in fact, we've designed proteins that prevent amyloid formation by basically binding to the monomers and preventing them from associating. So what I think we're getting better at is designing, you know, designing the core machinery. And then there's always the question of, you know, then testing it in a good model of neurodegenerative disease, and then getting it into the clinic is a big, you know, that's still a very long, complex process. But I think we're going to be able to design more and more powerful therapeutic candidates that operate, that can modulate these processes. I would say the biggest limitation is probably our understanding of the biology. You know, what are, you know, if you knew that, if you could just say, well, if you could make a machine that did this, and it would solve neurodegenerative disease, I'm pretty sure we could design it.
To your point about understanding biology, I mean, one thing, you know, we're investors in lots of the companies on the public side that have great modalities, right? Like we've seen incredible headway on the whole gene editing space, on some of the CRISPR. You know, a lot of that space has made, you know, enormous strides, even with approvals, obviously, for CRISPR therapeutics in as recently as December last year. Now, it strikes me that one of the issues or the advantages there is the diseases that are being addressed are diseases where we understand the biology quite well, like sickle cell disease, you know, been pretty well understood for decades. And it does seem that we're heading into a world where the gating factor is the biology and the causal biology. And do you think, is that getting behind the modalities at the moment? And you know, obviously the work you're doing is a great fit for the modality side of the house. But are you seeing gaps or any ways that your work can be discover new biology, or is that, do you think that, or are enough others working on that problem?
That is certainly, as you can design more sophisticated proteins and machines, you have ways of probing biology that you might not have, that you wouldn't have had before. So new types of sensors that can detect, and this is something we're working on, detect processes that are really, we can't measure now, and that could help inform about the, you know, about the causes of disease. But I would say it's both. I mean, I think our understanding of the biology is improving, and our ability to make new therapeutic, you know, powerful therapeutics is increasing. And often you learn new biology when you start seeing what therapeutics do in animals and people. So I think they kind of go hand in hand. I'll give you one more example, which is most antibody therapeutics currently, and antibodies are the major, you know, are kind of the currency of the realm in pharma for biologics. Most of them work as antagonists by blocking a particular interaction. So for example, blocking the TNF receptor pathway for inflammatory disease. Now, the way that, so you need stoichiometrics, you need amounts, you need a lot of antibody because you need to completely block the target. What if instead you could design proteins that bind to the target, but then destroy it in some way? Then you would require far less drug. So the toxicities associated with the drug could be less. The manufacturing costs could be much less. the ability to administer it becomes much, much greater. So as we can design more and more sophisticated functions, I think it really will transform the pharmaceutical industry.
It also strikes me that it's a great application area broadly for transformers. And of course, you know, what we're seeing a lot of headway sort of simultaneously, right, in transformers, in reinforcement learning, and in diffusion, and indeed where they converge. I think if, you know, if one thing that, that the whole ChatGPT moment has taught us generally, it's that, well, you know, what are these models good at? They're good at modeling nonlinear, complex, and long distance interactions in high dimensional space. And in obviously language is a great first port of call because we have lots of high quality input and we can understand the output. It's always struck me in biology, which essentially is also, you know, the language of life, whether it's the genome, proteome, transcriptome, what have you, in principle, these LLMs should be very good at modeling those same long-range dependencies and maybe even getting into the function in some sort of embedding space. But it feels it has felt so far that we've not fully realized that. But to your point, it feels like antibodies are very good, at least a modality end of that, because they seem very well set up for some generative AI, at least in the modality side and in the predict.
You know, transformers and attention mechanisms are really at the heart of the model, like the diffusion models I was describing for designing proteins. So the language models, I mean, you can sort of think of programs like Rosetta Fold, AlphaFold, RF Diffusion. They are foundational models, and they represent not only the sequence, which is what the language models represent, but also the structure. So in RF Diffusion, for example, you're explicitly generating in structure space. And in Rosetta Fold, and AlphaFold, you're sort of modeling both in sequence space and structure space. So you can sort of think, and I guess the best example of this is one of the design methods we developed earlier on was basically treating Rosetta Fold as kind of a language model in both sequence and structure space. So we could take a protein with a sequence and structure, remove part of the sequence and part of the structure, and basically do mass token recovery, but we're recovering not just the sequence, but also the structure. And so the standard one-dimensional sort of sequence generating language model is not quite what you want for problems involving protein structure and function, but these models that incorporate both sequence and structure, which you might think of, again, a multimodality language model, I think are really the models that are powerful today for solving these problems.
I have to ask you, obviously, last week there was an announcement of the AlphaFold 3, which kind of, the two things are kind of using diffusion models now there, and then being able to actually to predict the kind of structure of the proteins in kind of in different kind of biomolecular complexes, either with nucleic acid or the small molecules or the kind of protein. So, you know, what are your thoughts about kind of this new AlphaFold 3 and generally about being able to kind of predict the structure in the kind of biomolecular complexes?
So we published a paper in Science, it was actually on the cover of Science about a month and a half ago, that does the same thing. You know, basically you give it the sequences of the proteins, the nucleic acids, and any small molecules in the system, and it will predict the structure of the full assembly. It's actually kind of a longer story. We posted a preprint on this last fall, and then DeepMind, Google posted a sort of a white paper saying they were working on it too. In our paper, we showed we could not only predict the structure of molecular assemblies, but also design completely new ones. In the DeepMind paper, in the AlphaFold 3 paper that came out last week, they are focused on just the prediction problem, so they don't get into design. And it's what they show, actually, they directly compare to our method, and they show that theirs is more accurate. I think that more generally, the ability to model full biomolecular systems is really important. And I sort of alluded to that earlier when I said that to understand function, you really have to understand the full system. So I think now if you know what the components are, the protein, nucleic acid, and small molecule components, and you can build a model of the full system, it's much easier to get at the questions of function and how it works and so forth.
Great. And then I have another kind of, it's more orthogonal question, but what are your thoughts of the role of the kind of companies who are doing protein sequencing in the kind of, in the, for the protein design and engineering kind of space? do you think they're going to be, do you think and how do you think they're going to be helpful?
It goes both ways. I think protein sequencing will help with protein design, but I also think that protein design is going to help with protein sequencing. We're designing new types of nanopores that we're very excited about for protein sequencing and sensing. So I think that it will go both ways.
Great. And going back to the kind of to the your model that you published a month ago, how do you see, for example, now taking that model when you have and kind of combining it with some kind of high throughput screening to actually further improve the models, especially in the small molecule kind of discovery? Because I think that would be kind of, for me, the kind of holy grail when you can combine those two.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And that's a very important area. So far, these models are primarily trained on structure data, not on binding data. And so the more that you can incorporate other types of data, the more rich, the more you'll have more training data, so the model should get more accurate. They're still not, neither the AlphaFold method nor the RosettaFold method have this anywhere near the accuracy with protein small molecule complexes that they do with proteins alone. These are less data. But if you could train on things like virtual screening data, then it would get better. And also you would, conversely get better at the problem of given a very large set of small molecules, predict which ones bind.
Great, thank you. Just kind of, again, going back to the question of the design, when you think about designing the proteins, are you mostly in your lab kind of focusing on a kind of enzyme design or kind of proteins because, there is a kind of clear product there? Or, what kind of other categories of the design of the proteins?
Well, let's see, I'll tell you. So we're designing proteins that bind to cancer targets and autoimmunity targets for new therapies. We're designing conditionally active cytokines, for example. So proteins that only become active when they're in the presence of, in the cancer microenvironment or when other targets are present on cells. We're designing new types of DNA binding proteins for next generation gene editing. We're designing new vaccines. In fact, my colleague Neil King has a clinically approved COVID vaccine. We're designing proteins that bind to and neutralize viruses like Nipah and Hendra that are of current concern. Outside of biology, we're designing enzymes that carry out a wide range of reactions. I mentioned plastic degradation. I told you that we're trying to design sort of whole new classes of machines that that can take things that are in circulation like glucose or triglycerides and use and basically use these as fuel to power things like unraveling amyloid plaques. Completely outside of medicine, we're designing artificial photosynthetic systems that can transform sunlight into chemistry. We're designing systems that can mineralize inorganic metals, inorganic compounds to make new types of materials. That's just kind of a subset. So, with this ability now to design almost anything, really, really talented people are kind of flooding to my lab to try and design a whole new generation of proteins to make the world a better place.
Again, going back to kind of design, if someone is trying to kind of think about making a company for kind of protein designing or similar kind of things, how much should be thinking about mix of the kind of computational versus the kind of wet dry approaches? Because in my opinion, you still need both, right?
Yeah, you totally need both. And that's one of the things, if you came to visit my lab, what you'd see is many, many people working on computers and right next door, the people, often the same people testing the designs in the lab. So one of the miracles of this area is, how cheap and fast it's gotten to synthesize DNA. So suppose you've designed a new protein that you think should break down plastic. It takes you literally, a couple days to get a synthetic gene which encodes that protein, another couple days to make the protein and do the measurement. So you can be designing a completely new protein on the computer and within a week have an experimental result to see whether it actually did what you thought it did. And that's really important. You cannot do protein design without being able to rapidly go back and forth between computational design and experiment, because and that's how you really learn. So in all these, basically everything we do, there's really constant iteration between experiment and computation.
And do you think that on the experimental side, we are missing some kind of methods, or some methods are not in the right high throughput. You know, when I, for example, look at the kind of protein-protein interaction, there is not a lot of kind of high throughput methods, or maybe I missed, you know, but it just seems like that some of this experimental side kind of now need to kind of bring up their A game, but kind of curious to hear your opinion.
It's a good point. So a lot of what we think about is what are the appropriate higher throughput tests. So, but for protein-protein interactions, we've got that figured out. So if you give us a protein target, we can design and manufacture and test binding of on the order of 100,000 different designs against that target within 3 weeks. It's kind of amazing. I would say where that's much harder is, as I said, for the machines, where we're trying to say, okay, I want something that takes this chemical fuel and carries out this process. There, the assays are harder. For catalysis, some assays are easy, but some are hard. So developing screens that let you quickly test a reasonable number of designs is important. I will say, though, that as design methods get better, the throughput of the experimental methods becomes less of an obstacle, because we used to have to test, you know, 1,000 designs to get a really high affinity binder to get against a target. Now we can often get very high affinity binders in testing like 50 or 60 designs. So, but you're right. Developing every time we think about a new function we want to design, coming up with the experimental screen and test is an important part of that, because without that, you can't really assess whether you're making progress or not.
And Jenny, kind of thinking kind of forward, you know, what do you think are kind of three big kind of problems in protein design engineering that, you know, we'll be kind of mostly focused solving in the next, you know, 5 to 7 years?
Well, I've given you some of those. Like I said, designing sort of general methods for designing machines that can take in a fuel and do useful work, number one. Number two, making... highly targeted catalytic therapeutics. So active therapeutics that will, you know, not only bind to a target, but degrade it. There's a lot of exciting possibilities for mineralization. In nature, we have, bone, tooth, seashells. So we know proteins and biological stuff can mediate mineralization. But can we do that with, for example, inorganic semiconductors? And we have some really exciting results now showing that we can do this with zinc oxide and other materials. So what kind of things can we build? Can we come up with sort of a completely new way of assembling electronics by using sort of the self-assembly of proteins to guide that? Then another really exciting area is mirroring proteins with electronics. So we're working on ways to design brand new proteins that function within silicon to make measurements of things that are really hard to measure now. So I think there's a lot of really exciting area, both in medicine and outside.
It's very helpful to hear this. And then maybe, you know, just as a last question, what does inspire you? Like, what does actually drives you, you know, every day to the lab? Like, where do you find the kind of motivation or that kind of holy grail that you can achieve?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I have, I get to work with these incredibly talented people who are excited about, you know, they come here to learn how to design proteins to, you know, make the world a better place in a lot of different ways. And there's just so many possibilities and so many exciting ways to really do impactful things that I think the possibilities are truly exciting. The new capabilities are exciting. And then working with all these really wonderful people is just super exciting too. So I kind of love it all.
Great. Professor Baker, thank you. It was a pleasure to have you as a guest, and we hope to talk with you soon again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.